for so many beautiful teachings that we constantly are practicing, maybe without really being aware of, and they all fall very well in line with the main highlights of the Buddha's teachings that are well known to all of us. Say, for example, one of the teachings that we talk about a lot is the Four Noble Truths, and I don't want to go particularly into those today, but we very much are aware of the three characteristics as well. We got the sense of anicchang, like everything being impermanent, transient, and many of us do reflections on that, and we can easily see, for example, that 1 month of the pansa has already passed. So where did it go, actually? What happened? So we have all our little reminders of impermanence, of course. Every one of us, I'm sure, has a certain amount of those tricks to make sure that he himself isn't wasting his time without a practice and a sense of urgency. Then we have the sabbe sankhara dukkha, already mentioned the Four Noble Truths, of course, but there's also a reflection that we have every morning. Say, for example, when we recite the morning chanting, we declare what is dukkha. Say, for example, being associated with the disliked is dukkha. You can see that so much in the teachings of Wat Nong Papong, Wat Banana Chat of the forest tradition, that deliberately we sometimes are facing things that we don't like, and then get a sense of direct experience of what dukkha feels like and what it does to us. And it's not necessary, but it's deliberate sometimes that we have things that we should endure. For example, to sleep on a mat without any, say, kind of cushions, like samaneras, navaka monks, and even majima monks, should sleep just simply on a simple mat. And the padded mats are for teras. We have these inbuilt trainings so that we face the simplicity of life in one way, and then as well as that we expose ourselves to certain hardships, unless we're sick, of course, or unless there's a special reason that we're not going too far with imposing dukkha on ourselves. But there's a lot you can see in our training how things are designed, and if you read the comprehensive book that Ajahn Jayasaro finished about Ajahn Chah's life, then you can easily see how much it is a systematic part of Wat Bopong. And it still is like that, I would say. Like anicchang dukkhang. What about anatta? So there's so many things where we can beautifully see how the principle of non-self, selflessness or not-self is embedded in our daily practices. And this is some... not a matter of theory, because I think we can easily explain it to the guests or to our parents or to newcomers what it means. Like, say, anatta, we can go into all kinds of characteristics about the anatta that we know and that we can explain in terms of language, in terms of the teachings as they are delivered in the suttas. There's so many of those. For example, it's the five khandhas that we know about, and we can explain those. And sometimes on the Q&A session in the evening with the pakaos and the lay people, it goes into that direction, explaining all the concepts. And it's also fun because there's an experience of delight in the Dhamma, Dhammakamata, delight in the Dhamma when explaining the concepts. And I do believe that many of our experts in Pariyatti Dhamma, like the scholars, that they all have a lot of joy and possibly a lot of peace of mind through studying the philosophy of the Buddha as it is handed down in the scriptures. For example, when we think about the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, for example, it does ring a lot of bells with us, and we are fascinated by it, and we like to think in those terms. So that's one area where the concept of anatta is somehow present for us in a direct way. For us with educated background, most of us, like, we have like a sense of liking the thought experiments. And you can see the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is actually a thought experiment. So with the questions in there and then the answers, what do you think, bhikkhus? And you can go through it and indulge in the sense of satisfaction from the beauty of the teachings on that level. That's fine. But which other ways of practicing anatta are there in our daily life? I think there's quite a lot of layers we can come up with. And definitely the body contemplation is the bridge, for example, between understanding from the scriptures, say the non-self nature of the body. Many of us do practice to go through the 32 parts of the body and illuminate aspects of the body that we actually don't identify with, and then feel that we're deconstructing the sense of our self or pride in ourselves as an entity, so more or less disassembling it. And then of course the practice of the four elements, seeing the four elements, also falls into anatta. You can also expand the four elements into any other parts of physical constituents of the body that are more on the level of the chemical dhatus, elements that make up this body. Lompa Liam always adds potassium, calcium, iodine. He doesn't use zinc so much, but the obvious one is calcium, because a lot of the bones are made of calcium. Or H2O. could add aluminium. It's not too much in there, but I've got a lot of amalgamum, this kind of quicksilver stuff that you put in your teeth. plastic we also have. For those who have done plastic surgery. it's fun for somebody with a scientific background also to go through these things and expand one's, relation to these classic lists of dhammas a bit more, and go into something that makes more sense to us than, say, the four elements, some kind of very basic archaic way of looking things. Even though, of course, you can spend much, much time in investigating the four elements, and it leads to great, great benefits. But for some of us hearing them, so what, earth, water, wind, fire, so heat. Yeah. So more or less we can go through those and feel it's not our template, then we can expand more and think about the various things. You can go through the Visuddhimagga, for example. There's lots of explanations of these things. For somebody who likes this analytical approach, there's lots of food for thought. And as I mentioned many times, I feel that one can be creative with this and make things work for oneself. So there's this investigative quality where we try to bridge things that we have read about and that we hear about to our sense of self and our sense of identity, and start deconstructing it. And at least starting with the physical part, that's one very big part of the reality that we're facing, is the physical reality. And the Kruvajans many times say, if one doesn't start with the physical reality of the body and deconstructs the body in that way, then one maybe is overstepping a few things and is maybe up in one's head more than down in the ground in one's practice. And maybe the results that one thinks one has, having bypassed the body, aren't actually that deep. So something that I hear some of our Ajahns warn from, not skipping the body, because anybody can think things about the mind and proliferate and fantasize and feel he understands thought patterns or so, but a reality test is many times is how do we relate to our body. So then how else do we practice anatta? I think what I like very much in our tradition is that we also prove a sense of not-self and not holding on to our identity or status or role, and and our sense of pride in our actions. And so one can reflect on that as well, how much sila and the common virtues and the exchange that we have on, say, kind of holding ourselves back from expressing the things that we want, that we like, all the time, for the level of keeping sila together and being united in that and having a sense of kawat, in extension to the training rules that we just heard, have that sense of like putting ourselves in a system rather than sticking out, being special or so. And this comes very much to us, our way of sharing sila and sharing the commitment together and being in the structure that is outlined in the Vinaya. One can say it is a not-self system. It's not that there's so much privileges in there. Like I say, that we have certain training rules that only are valid for Navaka monks. So actually doesn't really exist. Like we have like the training rules, generally the ethical conduct is shared all through the hierarchy, and so there's a sense of taking oneself back and being in the structure altogether, and nobody having particular exceptions, and there's even no exceptions for fully attained arahants. And you can feel the solidarity on the level of conventions, even with somebody who is like completely finished in his practice. There's a sense of sharing and a sense of like uplift even. Like say if you see some very well-practiced monk, say, restrain himself in sila, it's very inspiring to us. It gives us a sense of uplift because we're all in the same boat. And it's very, very nourishing. So a sense of anatta in there, like he's not self, of course, by the five khandhas already, but he's also not self through, say, not eating in the afternoon or relinquishing quickly his Ovaltine, if he notices actually it has milk in there or so, and would confess it. So these things are very important as a sense of being together in the same boat and without anybody having a sense of exemption from things. And we all wear the same robes, for example, like, something that we don't have special gear, say a golden robe for the abbot or so. That would be nice. Or like say, like I think the Pope wears so many different hats and cardinals, and it's a real good color game. But we actually have all the same dress, and one size fits it all. It's a rectangular dress. The simplest way of making something out of a piece of cloth is cut it into a rectangle. Nothing more elaborate. So it's quite cool actually. It's very anatta. It fits everybody. One size fits all. So this one, for example, of course, like, while I'm saying these things, there's always little exceptions popping up, and we can see that there are, of course, certain adaptations, certain cultural things, and also in the Vinaya there is a hierarchy. For example, the best food and the best seat and so forth are according to seniority. And so there is just about the right measure of sharing things and then being in the ethical conduct all in the same boat. And at the same time, minor things are there to kind of push our buttons a little bit. For example, in our food line or so, we many times have to practice really that we take ourselves back, and whether we are at the end of the line by force because we're frustrated because all the super delicious Mexican tacos have already gone into the monk's bowl and we're just a little salmonera, so I have to practice anatta, I think. So wasn't in for me, so I can live with that. I can also live on sticky rice, it's fine. Like I'm happy to renounce anyway. But it's also for the ones in the front of the line, they know every taco that you take won't be available for any other bhikkhu in the line, so it's also sometimes a burden. Like if you're at the front of the line and you're allowed to take first, and you know there's 19 hungry mouse behind you. So it's not that we are scarce with anything, but like these practices, they really show how much we actually relate to the concept of not taking ourselves too important. And we have all these very beautiful inbuilt ways of relating to each other in terms of pointing out shortcomings, for example, where we really have to take ourselves back when, in this conventional reaction where people are insulted, get angry at each other just because somebody has discovered a mistake that they made. That is very worldly. Was in the Sangha, we actually take it on as a practice to say, thank you, you've shown me something that I wasn't aware of. Thank you for pointing out a treasure to me. Like, that's from the Dhammapada. Say, thank you for making me aware of something that I didn't see. And this is also like, really, one can many times feel it, how much this goes against the Atta, to say thank you, even though sometimes we are even unrightfully admonished. Something is accredited to us that we didn't do, but we still say, thank you, let me see. Or we don't just say, no, but... Or like, we don't just argue, but we say, come, thank you. And let's maybe you listen to the other person first, and then eventually, after maybe half an hour of admonishment, say, God, Tanajan, actually, I wasn't here yesterday. It must have been another bhikkhu. It's a cool practice of anatta, and you take it in as if it was you. Or like one of my favorite examples from Ajahn Jaya is like him going as a young monk to Lumpu Ban's monastery. Again, I think he stayed there 3 weeks or something like that. And he was super restrained, as is one of his greatest qualities. Super restrained, Rear Broy in every aspect. And always on time, meticulous, never chatting, nowhere. Just always sweeping 3 hours a day and things like that. And whatever practices they do, immaculate, more or less. And on the last day, Lumpu Ban has just been kind of a big father in the Lumpur in the background, and didn't come out that much. And of course, like as a young monk coming into a new community, you don't expect to be kind of singled out and asked to introduce yourself or so. It's just like actually quite happy to disappear in the crowd and not draw any attention to the Krupa-jan. So Ajahn Jaya was very happy about that, but on the last day, it happened to be wash day or something like that, there was one monk who was also very restrained, and they shared a little few stories about how the period had been, the 3 weeks, and talking Dhamma, talking direct experience, not gossiping, not chatting, not loud either, not long either. But it turned out that Lumpu Ban had summoned all the monks at the very time that Ajahn Jaya and this other monk were late at the Dainshi to listen to a special Dhamma talk that he was going to give to Ajahn Jaya on the occasion of Ajahn Jaya visiting. So, ouch, he missed that. And then so he came in there wanting to explain himself, saying, well, but just this one time, I actually didn't. Lumpu Ban was already launching into admonishing these chatty bhikkhus, always at the dying shed, always late, always, you're not going to get anywhere in your practice. And then Ajahn Jaya was like, had this impulse, of course, saying, no, it's just this one time, you know. And then, but like, he didn't get the chance, of course, and he just kept, doi, thank you. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. That means I'm guilty, I'm very guilty. So, more or less, it's like one of my favorite stories that he tells in one of the Dhamma talks, that like, one's got the urge to justify oneself, for example, being mistakenly judged or admonished or so, or unfairly or disproportionately. But as monks, we actually don't even do that. We just say, Kap, thank you. Kap. Next time I'll do better. So I think that's real cool anatta practice, to be able to do that and tolerate, so to say, what in worldly terms would be injustice, so to say. And This is a real test of anatta that I feel like that all of us actually really need to train ourselves constantly, and because there will be situations where we are treated unfair, and mainly in the monastery, in a good running core white session, these things shouldn't come up. Everybody's always polite and everybody's got mindfulness and immediately understands and has got a heart of loving kindness. But as soon as one maybe leaves the perfect sangha, then there will be injustice and there will be unfairness. So this thing about the loka dhamma, worldly dhammas, praise and blame, gain and loss, status and the loss of status, and then happiness and suffering is kind of things that Lompa Liam talks about. And as you know, Lompa Liam many times was unfairly accused in many ways. Like, and there's a lot of things to learn about that, and I find that's a real cool test of whether somebody can just recite Sabbe Dhamma Anatta, or whether he actually feels like that. He can walk away indifferently after having been falsely accused, for example. So, and then on the positive side, we have all these anatta practices where we actively do things to overcome our sense of laziness, privileges, conceit, wealth, abundance in special requisites like chocolate or like what else? Anything that we could share, gummy bears. We readily just give them out to other people. And it goes against the grain. Say, if you're given something particularly nice to you by your mom or so, and you then feel, actually, I don't really want to share it, but I can, we're supposed to share it. And so, or like, maybe I can share it and then share a little bit and then actually think, oh, come on, let's give it all away. So that's real anatta in a very different level again, like in a way of actions really, like in selfless actions, like both in the hidden and the open, as the Buddha says in the Saraniya Dhammas, in the six Dhammas to be recollected. And then the joy of living in a community where this is a culture of like inviting each other and stepping back, letting other people have the first opportunity rather than insisting on a privilege. My favorite stories in this respect was being at Lumpur Jandis in my second Pansa, and then everybody wanted to go to Ubon, as there were a few trips going to Ubon, and that was like a Katina or something like that. And I had just been there and in the middle of Pansa, but I kind of sensed that people like had reserved a place for me in the van, and there was only three monks could go and three would stay behind or something like that. So it was literally like musical chairs trying to pass on the rights to go on this trip. And everybody was saying, oh, Kivali, you should go. Kivali, you're from Ubon, you want to see your friends. You should go. And I said, no, Ajahn, you should go. No, Kuba, you should go. And I wasn't gang enough to pass it on to the others quickly. So eventually it ended up with me going, and I felt really, actually, I lost the game of stepping back from my privilege to go to Ubon. And it was really tricky. They made it all the way that, like, actually I had already said I'm not going, and I wasn't coming out even for the meal. And then one of the Skrubans actually ran to me and said, Lompa Jandi is waiting for you, you gotta go now. And I said, what? I wasn't gonna go. And he said, well, I stepped back last minute, I want you to go. So this kind of competition for making somebody else, giving somebody else a favor, something that many times our friends in the Bigger Sangha are very good in, and we're not so good in it. So I lost that game, which was defeat of my anatta practice. So they were much better in giving me the better part of the things, found better tricks. So it's like something to learn as well, to downplay oneself and try to have somebody else get the better position, the better invitation, the better robes, or passing on a gift that you just really want to give somebody else. So these are really beautiful cultures of showing that one doesn't attach to things, that one isn't kind of concerned about oneself. And I would say all these things, all these levels go hand in hand. One, the fascination with the concepts that we all have. We get Dhamma, Gamata, joy in the Dhamma, from thinking about the five khandhas and whatnot, and the self and the created or the uncreated, there's no self in that and this and that. We get joy out of that. It's a reality for us. That's one. The second one is like the body contemplation, or we break it down into the physical stuff that we don't attach to our outer experience, or like to our masculinity, femininity, that we kind of like not caring about looking at ourselves in the mirror, even things like that. We actually really work on that, getting aloof from identification with the body in all aspects. Find it actually really cool that so many years, like, I haven't looked into the mirror. Even for shaving, you can do it without a mirror, actually. And then the one by actions through body, speech, and mind, metta, kaya, kam, vachikam, manukam, both in the hidden and the open, that we actually have these practices that, like, we do selfless actions for doing something nice, say. It's not only the upatthaking or so, it's just also anything. Say, for example, say you see a monk who's only slightly senior to you and you offer to take his bowl, even though you're not obliged to by our system, by our sila or so, by our training or so, but you just want to do it and you want to make sure, you want to do his tags, like for me and, for example, Ajahn Sangwan or so, he's not too much ahead of me, so I just really... Actually, I'm happy if I can do the tags and for him. And this sense of competitiveness of service that we have. So it's not what we train here, like in terms of chores and the work days and being sangha officers. It's not only effectivity of the monastery that has to be run like that, but it's also passing on the spirit of real, genuine contribution and sacrifice and tambun, like making merit through renouncing privileges and giving them on to others, or having certain skills that we have and we share them. For example, we might be skilled in looking after sick bhikkhus and to volunteer, even though you wanted maybe to have a quiet evening, you volunteer to go to the hospital and look after sick bhikkhu or someone near. That's real dana, it's real beautiful act of selflessness, and there's so many things where we train ourselves to see these opportunities and not let them pass. And this is the positive side of all the chores and service and the work craftsmanship, or the ideas about like a forest monk looks after his dwellings or so. We do these things in a generous way and in a way of giving, and each time we give, like similarly to giving the tacos at the meal to somebody behind us, each time we give an act of service, like we're actually conquering ourselves, and that's a beautiful thing. And I trust that all these practices will take us all the way to really feeling different over time, and that it becomes a habit not to think of oneself, but think of the other people first, and that it becomes a disposition that eventually will lead us to the end of the whole chain of atta that causes birth after birth, identification after identification, not only in the say sense of realizing some concept of Dhamma, but realizing the causes that are needed to be relinquished so that we don't get reborn again in another identity, in another goddamn life, and be able to kind of be part of this whole, say, non-self Dhamma. Offer that for reflection tonight.